Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 20th of October, 2021, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with me, David Taylor, and Phil Bishop, our online news editor. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. Hello, hello, hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Really, I'm trying good. To stay dry. That's the name of the game today.
Yes, definitely. Yes, it's a wet old day. So nothing much in the news, unfortunately, so we won't have much to talk about. Well, there is something in the news, isn't there? But we're not going to talk about it.
Well, as any listener, I'm sure, will be aware of, in the run-up to the climate change summit in Glasgow at the end of this month, there's an awful lot of green stuff, net zero stuff. This week, the government published its net zero strategy, which we could talk about, but we've talked about all the elements of this before. We've talked about boilers being removed by air pumps or ground source heat pumps or adding hydrogen to the system. And Lord Bamford was outside, I think he's outside Westminster Abbey rather than the House of Parliament, with a hydrogen-powered, prototype hydrogen-powered digger, or backhoe loader, I should say, showing off, you know, what industry can do to reduce emissions and go net zero. We've talked about that before. Do you want to talk any more about net zero?
only to say
we'll talk about it again, I know.
But the thing is, I think I said this before, actually, so I'm repeating myself, which, of course, is not unknown. There's a constant stream of information and commentary about net zero and about the 2050 deadline and about decarbonisation and about retrofitting houses to make them energy efficient and all the rest of it, and people gluing themselves to the motorway. But really, there's very little new. Every time you hear something about it, it's the same old message, but maybe couched in a different way. The news doesn't actually move as quickly as the commentary. So there's a lot of talk about it, but not an awful lot of news.
But this is not one of those issues where something new happens. It's not like a earthquake in Guatemala or something.
Well, we've got until 2050, so I suppose.
Exactly. I mean, we've known about global warming and we've been moving in the direction of improvements, you know, for years.
Yeah.
And it's now all about a rapid cranking up acceleration of progress and trying to solve the challenges. So it's all about, and from the government's point of view, it's about, you know, winning hearts of mind and maintaining momentum.
Yeah.
And I suppose the new thing, or the good news from my perspective, I suppose, as a homeowner, a householder, is that I don't have to get rid of my gas boiler at a certain date and spend thousands of pounds on technology that may or may not work. Boris Johnson has said this week quite clearly, you can keep your gas boilers, but when they finally, you know, crank and need replacing, don't expect to be able to buy the old tech. You know, that will be when you get a new boiler, that will be when something different gets fitted.
Yeah.
I'm hoping, from my point of view, I'm hoping that it'll be hydrogen powered, I think. That sounds like it. I've no idea what the costs and performance would be of a hydrogen powered boiler, but just in terms of disruption, having a worry box on the outside of my house or digging up the garden sounds a bit of a hassle, but hey, we'll see where we are when the time comes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I suppose we'll have some news to discuss on that topic in a couple of weeks' time, once this conference is underway and all the world leaders are gathered in Glasgow and talking about
Some of the world leaders.
Some of them, not all of them. I think there might be one particular Chinese leader who isn't going to be who's going to be absent.
I don't think Putin's not going either, is he?
No, he wouldn't waste his time with that. He's got
too busy generating gas for us.
Yeah, exactly. So let's not talk about that, Phil. Let's talk about something far more interesting.
Well, yes, I would like to talk about, and again, this is a subject we've talked about before, but UK export finance.
Mm-hmm.
UK Export Finance is an arm of government, currently part of the Department for International Trade, which helps, it exists to help British business win business overseas.
Yeah.
So it's inherently a good and useful organisation where British company might say, we could do that project in wherever, Guatemala. We could win that road building job in Guatemala if only we could get the borrow some money from someone, or we can borrow someone from someone, but we need to get it underwritten, the loan underwritten. And this is where UK Export Finance comes in. It used to be, it had a rebrand. I can't remember when it was rebranded. It used to be the UK Export Credit Guarantee Department, ECGD. And ECGD had a history of controversy, embroiled in mostly other people's corruption, really. But it's when you're doing business with certain parts of the world, we know that there are brown envelopes involved, and there are certain times where you, for the greater good, you have to shut your eyes, hold your nose, and do whatever it takes to get the business to keep things going.
I think that's known as cultural diversity, isn't it, Phil?
That's a polite way of putting it. And it's become increasingly unacceptable. Organisations like Transparency International have kind of said, hang on a minute, this ain't on. If we submit ourselves to corruption in other nations, we are promoting and maintaining the existence of corruption. We've got to stamp it out wherever it is, which is absolutely right. And the famous example is the whole Al Yamana defence deal in Saudi Arabia, where the Prime Minister's son apparently did quite well out of it for arranging introductions and things like that.
Yeah, the Prime Minister being Margaret Thatcher at the time, of course.
At the time, yes. Not the current one.
Not one of Boris's sons.
So anyway, the reason why it's in the news this week, UK Export Finance, it has agreed to guarantee a loan, £363 million, to Bechtel. To build
that well-known
a road
British contractor.
That well-known British contractor to build a road in Serbia. Now, Bechtel has a presence in the UK, but the Bechtel family are loaded. And Bechtel is a very wealthy company. And it probably doesn't have £363 million cash to dive in. It probably does need to borrow money occasionally to take on these big jobs as just part of good business practice. One's immediate reaction might be to say, why am I, Johnny Taxpayer, here in Britain, lending money or being a lender of last resort, underwriting a loan to this huge, great American construction company to build a road in Serbia? What's in it for us? Well, apparently what's in it for us is that the quid pro quo is that Bechtel will create value worth £126.5 million to the UK economy, it is said. That's the deal.
Right.
So this £363 million loan, £126.5 million, Britain gets back.
Sounds like a good deal. Yeah,
That you can guarantee that in the next year's annual report of UKEF, it will say, we created this value. So I asked the question, how has this been created? Well, the answer comes back. They're going to use their UK supply chain. They're going to source lots of stuff. Now, if you're building a road in Serbia, what are the major costs? Let's go through it. It seems to me it's machinery, materials, and
professional
manpower,
services.
But not like I said, but labour. But the three
labor.
M's.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, forgive me if you calling about manpower, but materials, machinery, manpower. Those are the costs. That's what goes into it. Labour. Now, I'm prepared to believe that someone from Bechtel's London office might go out and help out on as a project manager. But I do not believe that British labour is going to be building this road in Serbia.
No way. No.
I do not believe that there'll be masses of British machines being used on this job. And I do not believe there'll be masses of British stone and asphalt and bitumen and being used on this project. So it's pretty hard to see what British goods are going to be exported to Serbia for this contract.
Well, I just mentioned professional services, and that's the only one I can really think of, that there will be desk jobs, probably still in London, yeah, rather than out in the...
I don't know if it's still Bechtel House in Hammersmith, but that's what I think of, right. Bechtel in London, yeah. on the big roundabout in Hammersmith. Yes, I quite believe that Bechtel's London office may be designing this job.
Hmm.
But that's, I mean, what's the design element?
6.5 million. Yeah, that's a huge proportion of the total cost, isn't it?
Yes.
So I can't believe that a bit of design and engineering would contribute that much. Might be wrong.
What I'm basically saying is, to quote Victor Meldrew, I don't believe it.
No.
I simply do not believe that sort of amount of money is going to come back into Britain by virtue of this job. So I asked UK Export Finance, you know, more details, please, and said, no, we're not allowed to provide details of specific commercial contracts. It's all commercial confidential, which doesn't really help the transparency of these things. But it does say that they will measure what comes back into the UK and ensure that there's compliance. And in 2021-22, for example, they say that... No, I think they've got that wrong in this email. But in the last financial year, 298 companies secured business with a project, I mean British companies, with a project that UK Export Finance is supporting.
Mm.
Now, my suspicion, there are a lot of successful entrepreneurs, business people, who make their money as wheeler-dealer agents, who will... For example, equipment dealers. There'll be someone at a desk in wherever it may be, Pontefract, who will arrange for a company in wherever, let's go back to Guatemala,
okay,
who wants a machine sourced in from the Netherlands, that he will organise it, fix it, do the shipping. You know, a machine is exported from the Netherlands to Guatemala, and someone in Pontefract might take a cut of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, it could be accounted in such a way that their turnover on that job, they've turned over, you know, £10 million machinery deal that they've done, whereas actually what their cut might be is 20 grand. So actually, yeah, at the end of the day, 20 grand comes into the UK, not 10 million.
No.
So in other words, what I'm saying is people in the UK might not actually be doing proper work on these projects, but might have fingers in pies and taking cuts. And my suspicion is, and there's nothing wrong with taking cuts and organising and arranging. I mean, you know, I'm sure you've used a travel agent in the past.
Sure.
They haven't flown the plane or cooked your breakfast at the hotel. They've just organised it for you and have done, you know, provided a valuable service. Fine, no problem with that. But there's a difference between the commission that the travel agent gets and the value of your holiday,
yeah,
or the cost of your holiday, I should say.
Yes.
Now, this whole business of the value that comes back into the UK from UK Export Finance, I'd like to see more flesh. The accounts published by UK Export Finance list these ball totals. They say, yeah, we spent this and we got this much back for the UK.
But they don't provide any detail.
But they don't say detail. They don't say that, you know, Freddy Window Cleaners in Ipswich was brought in on this job in Serbia and did the lamppost cleaning contract and got, you know, 25 grand that came back to the UK for this company in Ipswich. There's no detail like that because that's all commercial in confidence.
Just numbers.
So we just have to take it on trust.
Yeah.
Which...
isn't really good enough, is it?
And it's not, as journalists, it's not our job, and as taxpayers, it's not good enough, no.
UK Export Finance, I mean, you questioned them last year about a similar job. I mean, different people, different places, but the same sort of thing, wasn't it?
I think this was even more heinous, this one last time, or at least even more suspicious, I should say.
Okay.
It might be heinous, but I would certainly like questions asked. We reported in June last year, I say we reported, the UK Export Finance announced in June last year, and we reported that announcement, that they had agreed a direct loan, not to the contractor this time, but to the government of Benin in Francophone Africa, so that the government of Benin could pay Sir Tom a division of Vinci, the big French construction company. Mm-hmm. It's Vinci's division that works in Francophone Africa exclusively, to improve a 114-mile road in Benin. And UK Export Finance said at the time, this £100 million loan, 35 million quid is going to come back to the UK, to UK suppliers. UK, so Gier sets out to the Toms, UK supply chain is going to get 35 million quid.
Sorry, just to interrupt, was that a loan? Did we actually lend them the money, or were we underwriting another loan?
Well, this is all where you have to be very careful. It's all what they would say. It's not opaque, but the wording they talk about, UK Export Finance talk about supporting,
yes,
projects.
Sounds like working a euphemism for something.
Working with lenders to support and so on. But my understanding of the words used by UK Export Finance is that that this week's Bechtel agreement is that they are underwriting a loan to Bechtel.
Okay.
Last year, they actually, it was a direct loan to the government of Benin. Mm-hmm. Both transactions, both deals, served the purpose of guaranteeing money back to the British supply chain, to British construction companies, will get a slice of this.
Right.
It's you know, Britain using its soft power or financial influence to get winning business for Britain. That's what it's all about. Batting for Britain. Sounds great. Now, Sergei Satom, as I related last year when we spoke about this, has no presence in the UK. Right. Has no office in the UK. It's set up, it registered at Companies House, Sergei Satom UK, as a company in Britain a few months before applying to UK Export, at least a few months before this deal with Benin was all sorted out. Surely not a coincidence.
No.
Sergei Satom, I don't think, has appeared in any tender lists in the UK. It's not bidding for work in the UK. It has no employees in the UK still, I'm pretty sure. And this was getting on for 18 months ago. It's a two-year job. And this £35 million is supposed to, worth of goods and services is supposed to trickle back to the UK over the course of 2 years. So 18 months on, I went back to UK Export Finance. I said, which British companies have benefited from this? I said, it's all commercial confidential. We're not allowed to tell you that. You'll have to ask Sergei Satom.
That's outrageous. It's our money.
Well, yeah. So I've asked Sergei Satom, and I've admitted, it was only this morning I sent the email to them. It's work in progress.
Okay.
So I hope to hear back. And if anyone listening is working on that contract, do please get in touch. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. I'd love to hear about it.
But it sounds as if Sergei Satom came over here for one reason and one reason only. It was to, you know, get their hands in the piggy bank, wasn't it? And get some free money.
Yeah, although technically it's not them getting the money, it's Benin, but it's for their benefit. Now, Vinci, of course, the parent company, we know, does employ thousands of people in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's quite possible that some of the work on this job in Benin does involve Vinci in the UK. Now, whether it actually involves people who work for Vinci in the UK and pay British income tax in the UK, or whether it's simply a way of moving money through books and accounts so that it passes through the UK and goes, you know, yep, there's Ringway, that's a Vinci company, isn't it? Ringway does road repairs and road maintenance, and maybe Ringway is somehow tangentially involved in this project. Maybe Ringway sold its surplus machinery to this project. That would be, you know, perfectly legitimate, normal thing to do. Contractors in Western Europe, when their machines get a bit old and no longer meet EU regs, will ship them out to countries which don't have the same regulations. That's been perfectly standard practice. Maybe that's happened.
Well, I'm sure they'll let us know.
But 35 million quid's worth? that's a lot of old BOMAGs, that is.
That's true, yeah. Well, as you say, it's a work in progress. We have yet to find out what the answer is. But as I say, I'm sure that they'll let us know, because they wouldn't want a question like that to go unanswered, would they? Or would they?
They might.
Or would they?
Might.
I don't know. it's a bit depressing, really, when you think that this sort of these sort of deals are done, and then they turn around and say that these deals are commercial in confidence. Maybe we could make a request for.
You're talking about freedom of information.
Yeah, freedom of information request. I don't know if that would work. We could try it.
Well, I've dropped a note to the Western Isles MP who chairs the International Trade Backbench Committee in House of Commons to see if he can help get answers to any of these things and shed some light on it. I mean, at the end of the day, if UK Export Finance appears to be making money, if you lend money, whoever it is, whether they're, you know, it's a British customer or customer from another country or another planet, if they're paying a commercial rate of return interest, I mean, we know that banks and moneylenders are mostly very successful businesses. And so maybe we should forget about the whole batting for Britain. Just go, we're in the money lending business.
Well, just pay the interest and we'll be happy. But I don't think that's what they're about. I mean, there was reading about the deal. There was a quote by Anne-Marie Trevelyan, who's the UK International Trade Secretary, in which she said, and wait for it because you'll recognise the phrase. She said the deal will boost UK exports, drive investment, support jobs, and bolster local economies, helping us build back better. Oh, so there we are. Excellent. That's what it's all about.
So anyway, I would like more flesh on this claim that somehow these jobs in Benin and Serbia being done by French and US contractors that we are either underwriting or lending the money for.
Yeah.
That somehow British genuine British companies, not foreign-owned shells, are actually benefiting.
Bit of transparency would be nice.
Yes, please.
Yeah. Shall we move on to our next topic?
Right. Did you know on Monday it was Anti-Slavery Day?
I did know. I didn't know on Monday, but I found out on Tuesday.
You found out since 18th of October. That's because on Tuesday I said, what should we talk about in the podcast, David?
Yes.
And we thought we'd talk about Anti-Slavery Day. Whenever I hear this whole thing of, anti-slavery and we've got slavery going in British construction, you kind of think, well, I know that you keep hearing various Tory ministers saying we should put, you know, chain gangs of prisoners out to work, digging the pickaxes and quarrying for stone and things. I know there are proponents of that, but you don't immediately think that there is slavery is an issue.
No,
in British construction, but it doesn't take an awful lot of. Not even digging, other people are doing the digging. You only need to open your eyes to what's going on to find that it does go on.
Yes.
We reported, it's about once a year, the Gangmasters and Labour Abuse Authority will raid a construction site and free someone or some people who are being held under in servitude. I mean, it's effectively slavery. Modern slavery is not like something that, you know, Arthur Haley wrote about in his famous book Roots. It has a different manifestation.
These
days. It's almost always immigrant labour. The Gangmasters and Labour Abuse Authority website says that in the construction industry, victims tend to be male and of Romanian or Albanian nationality. Ages mostly unknown, but likely to be under 45, were reported. And they tend to be, basically, they're vulnerable people who've landed up in the UK with perhaps no English language knowledge. And someone says, sleep in my garden hut, I'll give you a bowl of gruel every evening, and I'll hold your passport for you, and off you go. And they're sort of outside the system and have no way of asserting their rights, and if they're legal immigrants, it's hard for them to assert any rights at all. And apparently this has become, there's a report recently out that with Brexit and the new immigration rules for Romanians in particular, it's even harder for them to say, you know, help, because they do not have the right to be here in this country, or they may not have the right to be here so readily as they did when Britain was in the EU. So there are issues there. So there are instances, and one instance is obviously too many, but it's too regular that people are being held. It's exploitation. It's excessive exploitation. I mean, Lord knows, lots and lots of workers in all industries feel exploited from time to time. Oh, do I have to do that, boss? Oh, you're exploiting me. Yeah. But I'm talking about proper exploitation.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's not the sort of thing you expect to find in the UK, is it? It's the sort of thing you normally associate with people building football stadiums in the Gulf States. Well, yeah. But now, these days, we hear about it. We assume it happens somewhere else, you know.
Yes.
You know, in Southeast Asia or, as I say, in the Middle East or somewhere like that. But no, it does it does happen here, to a less widespread and perhaps hidden extent that it's not as visible here, but it happens apparently.
Well, the other big areas where it happens, according to the Gangmasters and Labour Abuse Authority, it's quite prevalent in sweatshops, cotton,
yeah,
I was gonna say cotton mills, but the rag trade sweatshops. It's quite, I'm saying it's prevalent. It sounds like, you know, they're all slaves.
No,
but sectors where it is liable to be happening are the rag trade, nail bars, and of course, unsurprisingly, the sex industry.
Yes.
Well, yes, and agriculture.
And agriculture, but
I mean, because the sex industry, operates so much under a cloud of secrecy and so on. But it is happening in construction. Anyway, what the Chartered Institute of Building, this is week's news story. This is why we're talking about it. Not only in fact, it's the slave.
Get to the point, Phil.
The Chartered Institute of Building and the Construction Industry Training Board are backing the use of a new hand signal that exploited workers can use when they're unable to speak out, either because they're frightened of being boshed on the head if they speak out, or they might not be able to speak English. But it's promoting this hand SOS signal. Yeah. Now, do you want to explain it? You're probably better at describing this than I am.
Well, I've got some little icons on the screen in front of me, which clearly show what it is. It's three hand. Well, one hand, three things. Open it out. Open your hand out with the palm out. Tuck your thumb in into the palm and then close your fingers over the thumb. And that is a signal that you need help because you're being exploited and that you can't say anything about it. I suppose you've got to be pretty subtle about that as well. I mean, you can't go around waving your hands and clenching your fists and all the rest of it in front of your boss because you'll know what you're up to. Because if you found out about what this means, then no doubt your boss will know as well. But that's the idea. It was developed from an idea which I can't remember when this was started. It was a hand signal to allow people.
I think it was earlier this year, I think.
Oh, domestic abuse, that's right, yeah.
Yes,
so that,
yes.
You know, because, of course, that's a big problem. And again, it's another problem that is largely invisible to most people.
So the idea is when the postman or the Amazon delivery driver knocks on the door and opens the door.
Yeah, you can give the hand signal.
It's a bit like Mexico 68, Tommy Smith, Black Power salute, except with hiding your thumb.
Yes.
Do your SOS hand signal to the postman, and postman or delivery driver go, oh, I know what that means. I'll alert the authorities and get someone to see if they can help out.
Yeah, I think it is. It's the same gesture as well. It's not a special construction or slavery gesture, is it? It's the same hand signal.
It's to become the universal signal of I need help and I'm frightened to ask for it.
Yeah, how effective do you think this is going to be? Because is there any data about how effective it's been in the domestic abuse arena? I mean, have we noticed any more detection or anything like that?
It depends on victims or potential victims
knowing about it.
Exists. Yeah. And it depends on the rest of us, those who aren't in slavery, recognising it as well, which is why we're talking about it.
Yes, precisely. There are other initiatives. I just remembered another one. I can't remember what the signal is or the code word, but there is a similar sort of scheme whereby a woman who is in a bar or a pub and being hassled by a man can go up to the bar and ask if is it, can she ask if so and so is in, or if so and so has left a message for her? And the name, I can't remember what it is. It's code, and if she gives that code, if she speaks that that phrase to somebody behind the bar, they're supposed to know what it means and to actually smuggle her out the back way. So that's a similar sort of initiative. And again, I know about it vaguely. Obviously, I'm probably not in a position to ever have to use it myself, thank God. But I don't know whether or not it works, whether it's been useful. Again, it would be quite good to know if this is actually a useful and helpful hand gesture. I mean, I suspect that the sort of people who get enslaved in the modern sense, I know, probably don't have the will or the nous or the courage to do something like this. I don't know. They might feel that it would just, you know, bring the whole thing crashing down on their heads, and they would be either deported or they'd be smuggled away somewhere else.
And I don't know how much opportunity they have to come into contact with potential saviors, white knights, or whistleblowers. I think they're often not in nail bars. Obviously, they're interacting with the public on the whole time. Yeah. But in construction, I think perhaps are these gangs of people who are in victims of modern slavery and servitude who,
was it
subject? But if you ought, cricket club, we 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 club.